Hello, one and all, and welcome to the podcast we call The Fantastival with myself, Steve Nussbaum, in the podcast where I invite my guests to come on, talk to me all about their musical tastes, their memories, their experiences, and they get to collate their fantasy festivals, which I have christened Fantastivals. We are now on episode number 84, now well into March. I can't believe it. Time certainly does fly when you're having fun, and a massive thank you to Megan Wynn, who was my guest in the last episode of the podcast. If you've not listened, go back and check out the episode already. Great talent, great singles, and just a great person with a great musical taste. So she was a pleasure to have on the podcast. A massive thank you to Megan. But this is episode number 84, and I'm delighted to welcome on a guest who I've been after for a long time, actually. I've taken this from his Twitter bio. He said, hung out with a few of your favourite bands in the 90s. And in his pinned tweet, he says he spends most of his time tweeting about drugs, addiction, mental health, sex work, music, LGBT+, and lots of other stupid shit. He also organises the Neville Southall charity Twitter takeovers. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a Secret Drug Addict.
Hey, how's it going? You good?
All good, thank you. A massive thank you for joining me on today's Fantastival podcast. I'm really looking forward to talking music with you. But before we do, it's almost 2 years now. Lockdown is almost over. I was on the tube yesterday for the first time in a while, and face masks seem to almost be a thing of the past. It seems like society is moving on. So, mate, how have you been over the last couple of months?
I've been all right. Been all right with it. I kind of didn't mind lockdown. It was the homeschooling was a bit of a challenge, but generally I kind of just loved hanging out with the kids. Initially the first year of lockdown, then kind of when we had like the sort of second one or whatever, it was a bit like, oh, I could really, I've kind of done with this now. Yeah. Not a big fan of encores, do you know what I mean? I'll talk about that later, but I don't like an encore. But yeah, no, I mean, I can understand for some people if you lived alone or you was working, in a shared house or you was working from a studio flat or one bedroom flat, how it must have been really difficult for some people. Or if you were, if you had like sort of secondary illnesses or whatever, so you had to kind of be really careful about isolating, then yeah, I can imagine that would have been quite a difficult place. But yeah, generally I was kind of all right with it. I mean, I missed playing football. I missed going to gigs. I'm not really the most social person, so I didn't really miss seeing any of my friends. But yeah, I mean, it was lucky. There was loads of football on the telly, so that kind of kept me going. So yeah, it was all right. It was all right, actually. I could do with, starting to get out a bit now.
Yeah.
I'm a bit out of sync with, I'm so used to the routine of doing what I need to do and then just going home. And I'm still struggling to kind of find stuff like socially to do, what's going on the next week that's worth going to. It's like, I pick up a newspaper and I read a review of something that happened last night, and it's like, fuck, I would love to have gone to that.
So
it's been all right.
Good.
It could have been worse. I didn't end up on a ventilator, so I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, you're a really interesting person. Obviously, you've got a Twitter account that we're going to speak about, but your backstory, like you was in the music industry, right? Was that something that you always envisaged or wanted to be a part of?
No, not really. I think I've always loved music since I was very little, sort of 4 or 5 years old, watching Top of the Pops or listening to the radio. They were kind of, I've been collecting records since I was maybe six. My parents would buy me I think it was called Hits. It was like the compilation albums that come out every year. And I've still got them all. I've still got the first records I bought, my own money. And so, yeah, I've always loved music and found, the idea of, performance, there's something that kind of grabs me about being a musician. It seemed like very cool. These people were kind of cool. But I tried to sort of be in bands when I was a kid, but kind of realised fairly quickly that I didn't really have any kind of talent for that.
Yeah.
And I remember, the first proper album I got into, I think most people when they're kids, especially, of a certain age, they was out buying 7-inches or 12-inch singles, but they were singles based,
Yeah.
And they were affordable, so it was quite, you could buy lots of them as opposed to one album a month or whatever. So the first album that grabbed me that I bought was Pills, Frills and Bellyaches by the Happy Mondays. And like you would then with records, I think, you'd put the record on the record player and then you'd sit down and just stare at the sleeve and look at the artwork. And then you'd turn it over and you'd read the back and then you'd pull the sleeve out and you'd you'd read the lyrics and, you know, the stuff that was there. And I remember on the back of that album, it had produced by Paul Oakenfold stamped on the back of it. And I was kind of aware that Paul Oakenfold wasn't in the band, but that also no matter whatever happens in the future, he was intrinsically linked to this album. But whatever, I didn't even really understand what producer did, but I knew he didn't have the talent to be in the band as such. That was my understanding. And I just thought, you know what, I want my name on one great album. I want to be associated with one great record. And then how, you know, for whatever else happens in my life, I'm kind of, you know, partly responsible for the creation of one great record. And that was it. I didn't really understand anything. You know, I was maybe 11, 12 years old. I didn't really understand anything about what the music industry was or how you got into it. But I was kind of lucky enough to grow up in Camden, you know, and Camden in the early 90s in London was kind of the epicenter of the kind of alternative music scene. I suppose. I mean, you had stuff going on in Manchester. There was stuff going on in Scotland. They had their own little scenes. But, you know, the sort of music industry really was in London. And within that, it was kind of in Camden. So there was lots of record companies in Camden and lots of bands. Lots of venues, there's lots of small venues, so lots of up-and-coming bands would come to Camden and hang out and play there. And I just, because I grew up there, I drank in these pubs. I, you know, you'd be in a pub and there'd be someone, God, there's a band, there's a band playing at the back, let's go and check them out. And you'd go and check them out and it would be, I don't know, Placebo, just playing on a Monday night. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, and I remember, you know, there's just so many bands I could kind of mention, but, you know, another band I remember seeing that I really liked was I'm not a big fan of them as such, but when you watched them playing in a pub, you were kind of like, this band are obviously going to do well for themselves. You know, there's the Blue Tones, just watching them on a Monday night at like 7:30 in the back room of the pub. And at that, it was, I think it was just before they got their record deal, and it was essentially what they were playing was the first album. So you could tell, you know, they were quite strong songs. You could just tell that this was a band that were going to do a little bit better than playing the pub circuit. Do you know what I mean? But and then and kind of from that, just being around and making, you know, I was so young, I was like 13, 14, that I kind of stood out because I was so young. I was like this little kid that was just kind of roaming around Camden in pubs and at gigs. And a guy came up to me and kind of just basically offered me a job. He always saw me. I was in all the right places at all the right times. And, you know, he was managing bands. He was managing, he had Swerve Driver at the time. I think he was just about to take on a band called Reef. And he sort of just said, you know, do you want a job? So I started working in his management company, just doing bits and pieces and kind of learning. You know, going out on tour with Reef, you know, when they were doing the kind of, you know, the Splitter Van tours, they're playing lots of little venues, and that, you know, that was great. And it just kind of stemmed from there. And, you know, you're working with a band, you meet other people, you meet the industry, especially then, I think was quite small. You know, it was so you'd bump into other people, and, you know, you kind of know each other, and you get jobs because you know because of contacts. And just from that, really.
And then you found your way over to Creation Records, right? And at a time where it was all blowing up.
Yeah, that, I mean, before that, I'd ended up working at Sony, working in the A&R department at Sony with Muff Winwood, who was in the Spence Davis group. He was, you know, obviously his brother Steve Winwood. And a guy called Lincoln Elias. They were the kind of two main guys that I worked for there, and Lincoln had discovered, Jamiroquai, one of his bands. So I was kind of, you know, I was working with Jamiroquai, Terence Trent D'Arby, Desiree, Pauline Henry. It was, you know, there was a few bands there I was working for. And then, yeah, this job came up at Creation, and I knew Paul Gallagher, and I kind of knew Liam and Noel a little bit just through, you know, music and being around. And so Paul rang me and said, oh, there's a job going at Creation, you know, put your name forward for it. And I sort of turned up for this and went through this interview process and kind of didn't realise that basically because I'd been recommended by them, I kind of had the job already. All I had to do was go in and just not fuck it up.
Yeah.
And I didn't fuck it up, you know. So I ended up working there through the sort of, you know, the mid-90s till it... to about a year before it went bankrupt, you know, just as McGee kind of, I think they started sort of shutting it down around the beginning of 99. I think it closed, they closed finally at the end of 1999. So I was sort of left there in end of 98, I think it was December 98, January 99, something like that.
And then obviously while this is going on, you know, your Twitter profile was secret drug addict. I guess there's a lot of excess going on. There's a lot of drugs in the industry. Is it spiraling out of control at this point, or are you still in control of what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I'd always had issues, I think, with drug taking. My relationship with drug taking and alcohol was never really that healthy, I don't think, but it was kind of manageable. But as I got older, it just kind of got worse. And I think that my kind of ego just grew as the better I did. You know, I did very well very quickly. Yeah. I didn't end up running a record company. I was hardly David Geffen, do you know what I mean? Or Clive Davis or Seymour Stein or the Artigan brothers who ran Atlantic. I was an inch away from being a T-boy or something. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? I did very well, but my kind of ego just grew with that very quickly. And when you're sort of sniffing lots of coke or smoking lots of coke, that kind of drug is not, you know, I think it kind of exacerbates any issues you may have around ego. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not a great drug for that. And I just kind of got carried away and then found myself. I mean, the thing with addiction is it's like you don't really know you're addicted until you try to stop. You know, that's the kind of the irony with it. You know, it was only when I sort of, it was starting to impact in areas around work that I was like, I need to rein this in, and then found that I was unable to, that it became a problem. And the thing is, especially most, I think a lot of creative industries, especially then, and especially the music industry, no one really minds what you're doing as long as you're earning money. As long as you're getting the work done, a blind eye is turned to any excesses, you know. So, you know, I was very young at the time. I was still a teenager when I was working there. And I don't expect anybody, you know, it was no one's responsibility, but, you know, they, you know, nobody kind of reined, you know, took me aside and said, you know what, you need to slow down, you know. So I was kind of, you know, I was a child in an adult environment, earning quite good money with an expense account. And, you know, we'd do drugs, we'd sign a band, we'd do drugs in the office. We'd go, you know, I'd go and score, and then we'd come back and we'd hang out and, you know, we'd get some drinks and it was fine. And for most, I think most of the people there, it was kind of fine. There was a few other people I know that had issues and have sobered up since and stuff. But for me personally, I was very young and just didn't have the kind of emotional maturity to kind of deal with the situation I'd kind of been dropped in. Do you know what I mean? It was only kind of working there that I kind of realized how big Oasis were.
Yeah.
For example, you know, we had lots of big bands, but you know, the bands I'd worked with before, excluding kind of Jamiroquai, but that was kind of different. Jamiroquai didn't have the kind of fanatical following that Oasis did. But we had to have a security guard at Creation, you know, on the door, because people would just turn up looking for Noel and Liam. I mean, I got death threats there once. You know, we had to evacuate the office, and it was a whole messy thing. And for a month, I used to get cabs to and from work, you know, which was, you know, work, you know, work would pay for it. They wouldn't let me leave the office at lunchtimes for a couple of weeks, so people had to go and get my lunch because they were kind of worried about my safety. Working with other bands, it would play, you know, you'd be working with bands that maybe play, you know, one day at the Forum, or, you know, they'd be playing, so they'd tour to maybe, you know, 2,000 people a show. Then you kind of get dropped in the way, and it was just, I say, it was just fanatical. People would ring up the office demanding to speak to Noel or Liam, like they had a desk upstairs or something. Do you know what I mean? You know, it was, you'd go out for a drink with Liam, because he lived right around the back of the offices, so he was just, you know, so he'd be, you know, kind of be around, so he might go and knock for him and see if he's coming out for a drink or something. You know, some guys from Manchester, you know, we signed some school friends of his from Manchester, so if they came down to London, we'd kind of go and, you know, get Liam out and go to the pub, and it would just, there'd just be hassle. It'd always be hassle. There'd always be people that would, they'd initially want to buy him a drink, and you know, it was, I didn't understand, because he would always refuse a drink. They'd go, no, let me buy you one. And I was talking to him one day, I was like, well, you know, I'd take anything that's free, I'll take it. Do you know what I mean? Alcohol, drugs, I'll have it if you're offering. And I said to him, why don't you ever take a drink? Or something? Because, no, if they buy me a drink, they think they can come over and talk to me afterwards. So, like, you buy them a drink at the bar, come and sit down, and then they would sort of follow. And the conversation would always start off kind of pleasant, and then it wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. They would sort of give him a backhanded compliment, or they would get aggressive. And, it, you know, obviously, they wanted a story to go and tell their mates.
Yeah.
I think essentially, do you know what I mean? I had time I called Liam a dick or offered him out. Or, So it was just a level of sort of industry, I suppose, I hadn't seen, because I'd worked with very kind of niche indie bands before that. And this was big pop stuff. I just couldn't. I couldn't deal with it. It was too much for me. It was too much for me to deal with. My ego, you know. Paul Gallagher used to say to me, "You do know you're not in one of the bands. You do know you're not in the band." Because I'd just be doing drugs. I'd be turning up for work at 2 in the afternoon. I'd be coming and going like, and it was, you know, I got a little confused with what my position was.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. So you stayed at Creation for quite a while, but then you left Creation, but stayed in the music industry, right? And then it gets to a point where you know that you have to stop taking drugs.
Yeah, I ended up working at Mercury Records after that, and you know, the jobs became, you know, the money became worse. The office that I would, you know, the office that I worked, you know, my offices would always get slightly smaller, to the point where I'm in like a box room with no natural light. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was like the more I did drugs, the more problematic it became, the more it impacted my ability to work. So therefore, the quality of jobs that I'm getting offered, you know, dissipates. I got to a place where it was like that literally all the problems that I'm having are not caused by drugs, or at least made worse by drugs. You know, before that I could blame someone else. It was my boss. It was my girlfriend. It was my dad. It was, you know, there was always some idiot in my life that was causing me problems, and that's why I did drugs. You know, and it got to a point where I could not pretend that anymore. You know, I was, you know, right at the end of my drug taking. Work was essentially, you know, was now getting in the way of my drug taking. Do you know what I mean? Drugs kind of got in the way of work, and then it sort of became the other way around, you know. And yeah, it just, you know, if you sort of find yourself in a place and you kind of think, you know what, this is not how it was supposed to be. You know, I had a couple of things happen very, very quickly. You know, one of the worst of which was, you know, someone overdosed and died. And whilst you're kind of, you know, trying to process all that, you kind of think, do you know what, I thought I was going to be David Geffen. I thought I was gonna be Ian Wright. Do you know what I mean? I thought I was gonna play up front for Arsenal. I was gonna run a record company. All this stuff, and I'm so far removed from it that I just, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Any kind of delusion of that my life was kind of going well was kind of shattered, and I was kind of forced to address it really.
And that process, I mean, going, I mean, how did, this might be an obvious question really, but I mean, going clean, how was that? Do you have to withdraw, obviously, from your job, withdraw from everyone and kind of start again?
How was it? It was fucking traumatic, is what it was. I didn't really understand the concept of abstinence. I didn't really understand what a drug addict was. I'd gone to drug services in the mid-90s and said, look, I have an issue with my relationship with drugs. I didn't really understand what that was. And the conversation that I had with them when I would go and see them, I don't really remember too much about it. You know, I was going there, I was kind of, you know, I smoked a lot of weed, I was stoned, but, you know, I would have had drugs in my system. I wasn't really prepared to listen to what they said. I remember them offering me rehab. So we can send you away to residential rehab. And I said, yeah, but I'll be all right to smoke weed. And they went, no, it's total abs, you know, you can't do anything. And I was like, fuck, no, this, I don't have a problem with skunk. I don't have a problem smoking. I mean, you know, I was smoking an ounce a week. I couldn't get out of bed without smoking, you know. But at that time, the problems around smoking wasn't so obvious. I spent a lot of time in the house, in my pants, listening to music, watching movies, eating. Doesn't seem like, you know, when I went out and did drugs, I would stay out for days and, you know, I'd end up with kind of, you know, psychosis, end up self-harm. And there was lots of, you know, end up someone dying. There's lots of stuff. I didn't think that sitting in the house for a couple of years in my pants was a problem. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, I now look back and kind of go, well, there clearly was problematic, but the problems were a lot more subtler. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't so kind of obvious. So I wasn't really interested in abstinence. And then someone took me to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And again, I only went because the guy that took me had drugs on him. I didn't have any drugs. So he was like, come and meet me. So I went and met him. He took me to this meeting. And in the meeting, I kind of heard the guy, you know, the guy talking, and he spoke about when he stopped, he couldn't stay stopped. He was always, you know, always thinking about doing drugs. When he did drugs, he did more than he meant to do. He spoke about unhealthy relationships with women. And I just like, fuck, this is me. Mm. I thought I was the only person that had these issues. I thought, you know, I hung out, a lot of my friends were kind of, you know, degenerate drug users, but they were, none of them were ever as bad as me, you know. And so I thought I was completely alone with this stuff. And so at this meeting, I kind of heard all this this stuff that I kind of related to. And then at the end of the meeting, they kind of, they asked people if anyone knew wants to get up and kind of commit to this kind of way of life, really, you know, like, you know, total abstinence. And I'd had no interest in stopping, if I'm honest. I just wanted to kind of manage my drug use. I wanted to go back to how it was when I was kind of in my early to mid-teens. And I don't know if someone nudged me. I just got up. I was all excited. I got all giddy that, like, I'd discovered all this kind of new information, and got up, and everyone's clapping. And I went over, and they kind of give you, like, a key ring, you know, that says, like, just for today on it. And, you know, the guy gives you a hug. And I was all excited. I don't know what was going on. And then, I had absolutely no interest in committing to abstinence. And then someone sort of said to me, oh, where do you live? And I sort of told them, oh, there's a meeting tomorrow, you should go. And, you know, my girlfriend had left me at this point. I wasn't really working. I had a lot of spare time. You know, I was at a point in my life where I couldn't afford to do the amount of drugs I wanted. So, I was having problems there. And so I woke up the next morning and just, you know, went to this lunchtime meeting. That's just nothing better to do with my day. And somebody there sort of afterwards said to me, are you new? I said, yeah. So where do you live? I told them. They went, oh, you know, there's a meeting over there this evening, you should go. And I had nothing to do. So I went to that meeting. And the same thing happened there. And someone went to me, oh, you know, there's a meeting in the West End that we go to on a Thursday. You should come. We're going for coffee first. Meet us at 5 o'clock at Covent Garden Tube. So I did that. And I just did it every day. And then, you know, and then you hear more and more of these meetings and stuff, and you build up a network of people you're familiar with, friends, you know, support network. Because, you know, I think most drug addicts, they don't mean anyone doesn't do drugs. I certainly didn't. Everybody that I knew that didn't do drugs like I did kind of fell to the wayside. They either avoided me, or I just kind of stopped hanging out with them, because we'd go out for a drink and they'd want to go home early. They'd want to go home and the pub's closed, and I'm going, no, we need to, I want to go and score some more coke. I want to do this. I want to, let's go out to a club. Let's go, you know, let's go out all night. Someone's having a house party on the other side of London. Let's get a cab. So, you know, trying to get sober, and you don't know anyone that doesn't do drugs. So kind of meeting people that don't was really beneficial. And then also, as I say, having issues around, you know, struggling with emotions in early sobriety, you can kind of, you've got people you can talk to that can kind of, you know, explain, you know, what they went through, and that, you know what, it's all right, it's going to get better. You just, sometimes you just got to feel your feelings and stumble through it, or, you know, whatever the advice is. And I kind of had to initially change my life, change certain friends, you know, I speak to a lot of people on social media, and they can say, oh, you know, what about, you know, I've got no, what about my friends? And I said, you know what? I didn't fall out with my friends. We just don't see each other anymore. You know, we bump into each other sometimes in the street, sometimes it's someone's birthday, I go out for a couple of hours. But it got to a point where it's like, we just got different interests. And that's okay. Do you know what I mean? There was no big sort of falling out, like, I can't be around people that do drugs or drink. Because I sometimes am. I generally find it, especially drugs, I find it very boring sitting around watching people doing drugs. It doesn't, you know, going out for people when they get drunk can be quite funny, because they get a bit silly and you can kind of confuse them and, you know, take the piss out of them, and, you know, because you're still sober, so you're dead sharp. Do you know what I mean? So I that can be kind of funny. So, but just being around people like that, it doesn't really interest. And again, you know, with the sort of criminality that can kind of sometimes be involved with, you know, drugs, it's just not really sort of what I want to be around. And, you know, when that girl died, it was horrific. But what I kind of, you know, I'd sort of decided after that, because, you know, I got sober a couple of months after that happened. That was fine. That was like the kind of the final thing for me to kind of go, you know what, I really need to change my life. And I thought, you know what, I don't ever want to have that experience ever again, ever. And on a really obvious level, you know how you avoid seeing people have drug overdoses? Don't hang out with people doing drugs. I mean, it's like, it's not rocket science. Do you know what I mean? If I'm not with people doing drugs, there's a good chance I will never have to have that experience again and kind of see somebody going, you know, somebody going through that stuff. So So yeah, I tend to not do that. And you know, you get older, you have kids, and your kind of priorities change. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely do. So what was the thinking then behind the social media profile? Because obviously you're on social media, Secret Drug Addict, you're on Twitter, on Instagram, large followings, tweet quite a lot, you get a lot of interaction and engagement about addiction. So what was the thinking behind that? What made you want to get involved with that?
Well, it was a weird. Initially, I got on Twitter. I'm not really into social media. I'm not really one for sort of revealing stuff or, like, you know, talking about my feelings. I don't see the point of it. I don't get it. You know, for young kids, I know they're kind of growing up with social media, so they kind of treat it in a slightly different way. But initially, I got on Twitter to have a look at just because people were saying, you know, celebrities on there, and you can kind of interact with them. And I just thought it was kind of a really interesting kind of concept, you know, because to the kind of celebrities, they're kind of disassociated from people, do you know what I mean? And talk through PR and press. And then there was this kind of, you know, something they're on Twitter themselves. I mean, now I think they've all wised up. So, you know, they're a lot more guarded around the stuff that they say. But yeah, so I kind of had a look at it, and it was like, I couldn't work it out. I didn't get it. So I dropped, you know, so I deleted the account. I'm friends with Neville Southall, who, you know, if anyone doesn't know Nev, you know, give him a follow. He's on Twitter. He's a good guy, Nev. Used to play in goal for Everton and Wales. And he kind of built up this, he inadvertently built up this quite big following on Twitter, right? You know, I think he's got like about 180,000 followers or something. And we were kind of talking, and he was saying, you know, I've got this account. He didn't really know what to do with it because he's not on there selling any products. He's not trying to raise his profile. He's just on there, you know. And he was saying, you know, what would be great if we could get good causes and you know, mental health, addiction, and kind of, you know, you know, platform these kind of subjects. So I created the Secret Drug Addict account. And, you know, a lot of people kind of go, oh, it's I get why it's a secret because of the stigma around addiction. And it's like, you know, I'm going to be 15 years sober, 15 years clean, whatever, abstinent in June. There's no stigma. People kind of, if I meet people and I say, oh, you know, I'm a drug addict, they go, like, they basically think now that I'm cured, or that I will never use drugs again. I'm trusted with people's keys to the office. Yeah. You know, people trust me, right? So it's not around that for me. I understand if you're in early recovery, or if you're still in active addiction, there's obviously can be stigma attached to it. You know, like I had a friend who was he couldn't stop smoking crack, but you could trust, you know, you could trust him. He'd stay, you know, he'd sleep at mine, and I'd wake up in the morning and he'd be gone to work. None of my stuff was gone. Mm. Do you know what I mean? You know, he wasn't, you know, you could, he'd lend him money, give you the money back. Now, again, I wouldn't say that about every using drug addict, right? You know, myself included in that. But, you know, not all of them are thieves or untrustworthy. Do you know what I mean? But the assumption is that all drug users are untrustworthy or stealing or dishonest or whatever. But again, you know, there is quite a high number, I suppose. But anyway, so I set the account up, and I didn't really want to be Twitter famous. I didn't really want it to be about who I was. I'm not trying to position myself as some sort of addiction influencer. You know, I see some of that stuff on like TikTok and Instagram and on Twitter, and it kind of makes me uncomfortable. I just think it just makes me feel icky. It's kind of like, oh, you're on here to help people, but are you really here to help people, or is this about you trying to, you know, give yourself an online personality? I just thought, you know, keep it anonymous and just focus on what it is that I want to do, which is kind of talk about addiction, help people. You know, I tweet lots of other daft stuff, you know, on there as well, stuff around music. You know, I'm quite vocal about stuff around, you know, decriminalising sex work and, you know, people, you know, having the right to choose what they want to do with their bodies and, you know, stuff around harm reduction around drug use. So I'm not one of those kind of, I say mad people, I don't mean it like that, but just, you know, sort of total abstinence. You know, you've got a problem with drugs, stop doing drugs. You know, I understand that harm reduction works for a lot of people. You know, ideally, I'd like people that have drug issues to just stop using drugs, because I think that might improve their lives. But to do that, I want to keep them alive. So if you know, if there was places, they're trying to do it in Scotland where you can, you know, you can go and you know, rooms where you can inject drugs safely or as safely as you can. So it's like clean needles and stuff like that. You can test your drugs, you know what you're taking. Because the reality is, I suppose, is that you can, you know, I mean, Keith Richards is kind of testament to it. You can shoot heroin for a very long time and not die. Mm. You know, I mean, most overdoses are because people don't know what they're taking, how strong it is and, you know, how clean it is. With stuff around harm reduction, you know, clean needles, you then reducing HIV, you know, hepatitis, all these kind of health things, you know. So I'm quite, you know, supportive of those kind of things as well. And then any other kind of daft stuff that takes my interest on Twitter, really. But yeah, so it started with that, and then Neville, it kind of grew. And then, you know, me and Neville kind of exactly the waste that are dumping it in the water and stuff, you know. So, well, you know, I get those, and I'm talking to another organisation at the moment, a charity who you can donate your hair to, who, you know, make wigs for children with cancer. So we'll do something like that. Then it'll be something in and around, I don't know, like, you know, women's groups. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, I'm going to talk about it in a bit, but, you know, safe gigs for women. Who turn up, but you know they go to gigs, they go to festivals, and they kind of, you know, they look to kind of address the issues around sort of sexual violence and abuse and assault of women in music venues, you know. So I'll get them on to talk about stuff, and they can, you know, they can ask for donations, they can tell you where they're going to be, they can talk about why they do what they do, how you can volunteer. And so literally we have on the most random kind of good causes. So it could be sort of like an Alzheimer's group, it would be, let's say, safe gigs for women, it would be a wig charity, just anything that I think is kind of should be, you know, people should know about, really. So it's just kind of growing from there, and it's just kind of got bigger and bigger, you know. And it seems to work, and it's kind of fun. I enjoy being part of something kind of positive.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's such a positive account. And that you've made what was essentially a negative into a positive, and helping so many people along the way. So kudos to both you and Neville Southall as well, who's actually using his Twitter account and his influence for good, and to spread messages for goodness where quite a lot of people don't, which is great to hear. So music-wise, obviously you're a massive music fan. You've spoken about seeing Placebo and Blue Tones in back rooms, which sounds incredible to me now when you're talking about it.
I'm sure I could have picked two better cool bands. They were just the ones. I just remember them both playing the Dublin Castle in Camden. That was, and I think Kaniki played there once. So there was loads, but yeah, I definitely could have picked cooler bands to make myself sound cool.
So what type of music are you into? Because obviously creation comes with a stigma of indie. I saw you tweeting the other night about Iranian dance music or Iranian hip-hop. And so it seems like you've got you've got like a really...
I can't even pronounce that guy's name, man. it's like Yagush or something. It's like Iranian psychedelia from the early 70s. Initially, I was kind of into, you know, it was pop music as a kid.
Yeah.
You know. But then, you know, the first kind of music that was like, you know, my music, I suppose, was, you know, stuff from the early 90s. So it would have been, you know, Sonic Youth, My Bloody Valentine, Teenage Fan Club, Nirvana, Bikini Kill. Also quite a big dancehall fan. Late 80s, early 90s dancehall. I'm a bit of a connoisseur of, which a lot of people seem to find funny, because I sit in the house just crashing out like Shabba Ranks and K-Porter and stuff. I mean, I have a bit of an issue with it now, because obviously as at the time you didn't really think about it, but you know, there's lots of homophobic kind of lyrics in it that are not ideal, especially if you've got children. Do you know what I mean? I kind of have to try and be quite careful what I play around them. I don't like to censor music. But, you know, if there's something like that, or kind of some of the hip-hop with a kind of misogyny, and again, I mean, there's a lot of misogyny in dancehall, I kind of try and explain to my kids that it's not, you know, this is not real. It's just, you know, it's not right. It's a song. It's kind of, you know, it's steeped in fantasy or whatever. Do you know what I mean? You shouldn't be taking this stuff literally. But yeah, it's difficult with music nowadays. You know, like, you know, I'm a big fan of... of Ryan Adams and Whiskey Town and you know, feel quite uncomfortable listening to him over the last few years because of the, you know, the issues that he's kind of had publicly with women.
I don't know if you know this. Maybe, you probably don't, actually. Right now, I've got a big three in my world. So my big three is Springsteen, Bryan Adams and Ryan Adams. I don't know if you've seen it. You probably have. Ryan has just announced his first gigs again in the States.
I didn't know that.
He sold it out straight away. He's doing the New York Auditorium that is quite famous. He'd done it. He released a vinyl concert last time he played there of it, and he's just re-announced his first show for May. So an exciting time if you're a Ryan Adams fan.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would like. I haven't seen him for years. I would like to see him. It's a difficult one because obviously, you know, how can you be a drug addict and then sort of, you know, not forgive other people for past tracks? I mean, there's a line. Do you know what I mean? There's a line. Like, you know, I was talking to a guy the other day who's a professional footballer. He's actually playing tonight against Everton, right? A guy from Boreham Wood, and he went to prison a couple of times. And you know, I was talking to him about some social media stuff. This was, you know, with Neville, before they got drawn the game, right, against Everton even. And one of the first things I had to say was like, you know, what did you go to prison for? I've got no judgment on that, but I'm like, if he's killed somebody or like, you know, raped a woman, there are certain things we kind of go, do you know what? We all make mistakes and we learn and we grow, but there's other stuff we kind of go, not sure how we forget. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. Yeah. It just becomes tricky. And, you know, I'm absolutely far from perfect and made some terrible, terrible mistakes, you know, with women, you know, my behaviour. But I don't know, I do feel a little uncomfortable. But you mentioned Bryan and Ryan Adams, because I worked for both of those when I was at Mercury.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Signed Greatest Hits by Bryan Adams somewhere here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know you were a big Bryan Adams fan.
Yeah, I'm seeing him. This goes out on the Sunday. I'm seeing him at Prism on Tuesday. He's got a new album coming out. So Prism and Banquet Records are doing like this little small club gig, which I'm going to with my good friend. So I'm looking forward to that one. When you said Mercury, I thought I always associate Mercury with certain acts. And Brian fell in my head.
And it's Bryan Adams. That's the best you can come up with.
So is there anything at the moment that you're listening to? I always like to ask people about what they're listening to. So I don't know if you've seen on Netflix, there's a new Kanye West documentary about his like rise from when he was trying to get signed.
Yeah, I'm going
to
sit down and watch
that's
that.
It's amazing. And it's got me kind of back into his early catalogue, and there's like a lot of Mos Def stuff in it and Talib Kweli in it as well, which I'm kind of getting back into now and don't necessarily listen to when it was out. What about you? What are you listening to at the moment?
I mean, I do love early Kanye West.
Amazing.
A friend of mine played on his album.
Wow.
I wasn't really paying attention, if I'm honest. I think I just stopped doing drugs and my head was battered.
Yeah.
And a guy that I'm friends with a guy called Ben Hudson, who was in he calls himself Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Hudson.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Ben's an old friend. I knew Ben before he even had a record deal. He lived down the road from him. We kind of hung out in the same hairdressers and stuff. And yeah, he came back and he went, I've just been over in Hawaii, like playing with Kanye West. And he like listened to the album. He's on it, you know, a little bit. And then the next thing, Kanye signed him and has produced his album. I think his solo album. I was like, fuck, I should have got something signed. I should have got him to give me something signed from Kanye, man. But yeah, no, I mean, it's weird. Kanye's one of those artists, I think, that he's kind of Marmite, you know. I've spoken to people who like hate him, you know, like even musically, and I'm like, the guy is a genius producer, you know. Those first sort of, you know, 2, 3, 4 albums or whatever were absolute, and even some of the later stuff he done, absolutely like spectacular. I mean, even when he played he headlined Glastonbury, didn't he? I don't know, was it 4 or 5 years ago maybe?
Yeah, at least.
And I thought it was brilliant. Like, people were kind of going, it's a disgrace. It's, you know, it's a rock festival. He shouldn't be performing. And I'm kind of, I went back through the headline in acts, and it was like, you know, I think like U2 and Coldplay. And I'm like, man, that stuff is far more offensive than Kanye West play. I'd much rather see Kanye West than that. And it was like, I just remember he had the light show, he had the lights above it, and they were kind of going off and on, and they were rising and they were going down. And it was like literally just him on stage with a DJ behind him for 2 hours. And, you know, lots of it didn't work. I remember the bit where he sung Bohemian Rhapsody, and he got it all out of tune, and everyone was like laughing at him and trying to sort of mug him off. And, I, you know, for me, I'm kind of like, you know, if you play for 2 hours, I, you know, if you're, There's no great artist that is not gonna, you know, not gonna get in the car and crash it. Mm. Do you know what I mean? If you're safe, you're kind of boring. Do you know what I mean? And I thought the idea of him sort of being up there and taking risks really interesting. And the fact that it crashed in certain places, it worked in others, I think made it more interesting. Do you know what I mean? Kind of showed, you know, what an artist he is. You know. So I loved that performance. I've tried to find it on YouTube to watch it again, and I don't think it's up there. There's like loads of other bits and pieces from Glastonbury, but not that. But yeah, I don't know if his next record's going to be of any value, but he seems to have kind of, I mean, obviously he's got mental health issues. I don't think, and to start with, it was kind of funny, I suppose. People were like, ha ha, kind of done something mental. Now it's kind of like, it feels a bit sad. It feels like he's not getting the support that he needs. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But stuff I'm listening to, what am I listening to? That's a good question. Salt. I love that band Salt. Their untitled albums I thought were really special. Yeah. You know, and I didn't really know too much about them. And I kind of liked that about music. When I was younger, I would want to know everything. Yeah. I'd want to know who's in the band, what record company they were signed to, who produced it, what their views were on world hunger, all that stuff. Now I don't really care about, like, you know, the background of any bands anymore, and kind of Salt for me were kind of perfect because I'm still not really sure who's in the band. You know, it was just this kind of record came out and there was a kind of a purity to that. It wasn't about what they looked like, it was just, you know, what's on the album, what's the noise, you know, what, you know, the songs.
So
I'm kind of really into them. What else am I listening to? Wargasm, with this kind of two-piece kind of noisy sort of metal band, I suppose. I ended up bumping into their manager, bizarrely enough, at a women's skateboarding event which I took my daughter to. And there was me and this other guy who would obviously take, you know, he'd taken his daughter too, I think. And we were just literally the only two fellas there. So we started talking. And he mentioned he managed Wargasm.
Oh, wow.
I was like, I love that band. You know, they're quite, I don't know, you know, they've only put a couple of singles out. But Lone Lady, I quite like. Her record came, I think it was last year, maybe the year before. The Dry Cleaning album, I thought was brilliant. Black Country, New Road, Amel and the Sniffers, I quite like. You know, I quite like the energy of them, and I think she's quite cute. Ghost Mane, I saw this guy called Ghost Mane, never heard of him before. My mate's son, Reading 19, it was just before the first lockdown, said to me, I'm going to watch this band. Now, I go to festivals now, I barely get out of the guest area. There'd be like a couple of bands I want to see, but normally I'm just kind of go to take the kids and, you know, catch up with pals. And he went, oh, we're going to watch this band. They're playing like the smallest tent as far away from the guest area as you can get. You know, I haven't been over there since it's like near the campsite. I haven't been there since like 1994, that far away from the main stage or the guest area. So I've gone over with him. I think they were headlining. And I was like the oldest person there. It was just kids. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant. It was kind of like a sort of SoundCloud rapper metal kind of thing. And I went home and looked him up on Spotify, and the kid's getting like 80 million streams, 100 million streams. So I'd never heard of him before. So it's like, apart from feeling kind of old, it felt kind of cool that there was this stuff happening that young people were doing that old people like me maybe don't know about. You know, which is how it should be. Do you know what I mean? It's really, you know, it's, I think, you know, I don't think music generally is, I don't think it's as young as it used to be. I don't think young people are really going to concerts like this because it's so expensive. And you've got to get, and you know, if, I mean, you could, I remember you used to be able to go up and get, you know, and basically buy into a concert, you know, buy a ticket after the doors opened.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like quite big bands, you know. You know, they certainly wouldn't be selling out in 20 minutes. Do you know what I mean? You'd be able to go to the Reading Festival, Phoenix Festival, and people could just buy tickets on the day, for the day, like a day ticket, you know? And they were cheap. It was really kind of accessible. And so I think that young people have, you know, I go to concerts now, and I try and see lots of modern bands and, you know, young bands. I rarely see young people there. They always seem to be kind of in their 30s, you know, which I think is a number of reasons that yeah. music's not important. I think that's one of them. It's not, if you know, if they can't afford to go, then they're kind of not really going to be that interested. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, there's a few bands. Benefits, I like. There's the new band called Benefits from Northeast, I think they are. They've just done their first tour of the UK. They're really good. They're really worth checking out. They're on Spotify. So you're going to have a listen to them. I think that's it, really. I mean, there's loads of others I could name, but it'd just be boring. Do you know what I mean? Just be machine gunning names at you. Do you know what I mean?
Some great names mentioned there. A lot of, like, FOP. Obviously, I work for H&V. A lot of FOP albums of the months you've spoken about. So, like, Dry Cleaning.
I've got no idea.
Yeah.
I'm kind of isolated with that stuff. I said before, they kind of look in and wanting to know. And, you know, I don't really buy records like I used to for a start. But, I just kind of sit at home and come across stuff, or someone might tell me. But I've got no idea how big the band is or isn't. You know what I mean? Unless you go and see them, and I kind of, you can gauge them off of what, you know, the venue sizes that they're playing. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's bad because there's some bands, they get huge streams on Spotify, and you think, oh, they must be massive, and then they're not.
Yeah.
And sort of vice versa. Do you know what I mean? So it's, but yeah, sound like, I didn't know there was, well, it looks, well, sounds like FOP's got whoever picks the albums of the month's doing all right there.
Yeah. Not too bad at all. So this podcast is all about collecting your own fantasy festival. You've mentioned going to VIP spots in Reading and watching acts. Are you a big festival goer? You enjoy festivals, or are you happy to kind of chill out now these days?
Do you know what? I do like going to festivals. I tend not to go so much for the music now. I find that most festivals are a bit, they're a bit more generic, I think, in the acts that they pick. I think a lot of people that go to festivals now are not really there for the music. I think that's kind of secondary. I think it's more about the experience now of camping, of getting drunk with your mates, of 3 days of sort of carnage. You know, when I was first started going to festivals, you know, sort of, you know, 13 or whatever, like Reading Festival, like the very early 90s, I'd have a bit of paper and I'd have scribbled down what the bands that I wanted to see. And there was this band playing on the NME stage. And if I can catch the first half hour of them, and I can go to the other 10 and catch the last 20 minutes of that band and then go over to here. And it was like some sort of military operation where you would just run from stage to stage to see all the bands you want to see. You know, I haven't been to a festival since before lockdown. I was, you know, I had planned in 2020 to go to, I was going to take my daughter to Glastonbury to see Taylor Swift, which I'm not sure which of us was more excited about that. I'm a massive Taylor Swift fan. You know, I took my daughter to see her twice already. First time I took my daughter, she was 16 months old.
Wow.
And I got her a little Taylor Swift printed her a little Taylor Swift t-shirt and stuff, and you know, it was great. And that's again the sort of beauty about sort of working in the music industry is you get some good stuff. So you can get, you know, you get good passes, you can get signed stuff. So my daughter's got, you know, she's got a couple of signed Taylor Swift posters on the bedroom, and do you know what I mean? Things like that. But so yeah, Glastonbury, I was looking forward to going, and there was a couple of things at Hyde Park. I think she might have been playing Hyde Park as well. I think we were looking to go to that. So that kind of obviously all got cancelled. And then Reading last year, it just looked a bit shit, like even more shitter than usual, if I'm honest. I think because there wasn't many American acts travelling, there wasn't many foreign bands playing, they were kind of having to rely on UK bands. And I just don't really think, and there's other festivals going on, so you can't, you know, so when they were booking, I just don't think it really, it looked even worse than usual. I thought, I can't face it. So I haven't been to any since 2019 is the last one. But we'll probably go to a couple this year. I'm not a big camper. I can't do camping. I refuse to camp. I think I camped Reading 92, and it just broke me. It was the most horrific experience ever. I mean, I know campsites now are a lot better. They have running water. There's places where you can get like your mobile phone charged. There's like, they have stuff. Back in the early 90s, it was just a field. It was like, you know, it was like Mad Max beyond Thunderdome or something. It was just, they were medieval. Do you know what I mean? You know, but yeah, no, we'll probably go to a couple. And I've got a serious plan. I think we're going to one in Belgium. We're going to see Nine Inch Nails play. I think it's in Belgium. I've got no idea. I thought it was in April. Apparently I've been told this later in the year. I've got no idea what's going on most of the time, if I'm honest. My missus will kind of tell me where we're going and, you know, what we're doing. But yeah, no, I do. Initially, I loved festivals. I think when, you know, in the early 90s, when I was young, it was a great place to kind of meet people that were into the same music as you. Mm. You know, I didn't, you know, because the indie scene then was very, very small. So you might have a couple of mates that was into what you was into, and that was kind of it. And then you'd go to like a club and there'd be 300, 500 people. And it was like, fucking hell, it's 500 people that are all into the same music. And then you go to a festival and it was like, I mean, they were a lot smaller then as well, I suppose, but it'd be like, there's 30, 40,000 people from all over the country, from Scotland, from Wales, from the Northeast, and we're all into the same stuff. And it felt really kind of like community-based. And I don't know, now I went, you know, I remember going to the V Festival before it finished a couple of years ago. The V Festival was never really a cool festival. It was always a bit more pop. And it just felt like no one here likes music. I didn't know what people were doing there. You know, I mean, maybe that's my sort of, you know, preconceived judgments on people. But yeah, it didn't feel like it was it felt like it could have been anything.
Yeah.
Just a day out for people to get drunk in the sun, which is fine. Do you know what I mean? You know, that can be fun. But it just was like, it just felt a bit naff.
I get that. I completely get that. And before we talk about your fantasy festival, are there any gigs that you look back on and just think that you can't believe you were there, or ones that stand out for you? I'm sure you've been to many.
Do you know what? There's probably loads, but sadly, I was so, I can't think of the right word, because I've kind of worked in the music industry and been privileged to kind of be around it from such a young age, I didn't really appreciate it. Like, you know, I've got all my tickets, all my guest passes, all my laminates, all framed in my downstairs toilet. So the whole toilet's kind of covered with either pictures of my daughter's drawn or tickets. And so when people go and like go to use the toilet, you know, someone comes down the house to use the toilet, they come out going, oh, fucking hell, man, I was at that show, or, you know, that show must have been amazing. But at the time, it was like, I probably spent most of it in the bar, talking nonsense with someone that I'm not even in touch with anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like, the stranger next to me, as I'm getting served, we end up talking about Arsenal for 25 minutes. Do you know what I mean? Just like, you know, and there was like this amazing show, this moment in time, and I missed it. I was in the toilets doing drugs, talking bollocks and... You know, just the stuff like that. But, you know, I think the shows, I kind of felt like they were special, even though I probably, you know, didn't appreciate it properly, was I saw the Prodigy play the Marquee in the West End before that closed. And the Marquee holds like 500 people. And it was just before No Good Start the Dance came out. So it was just before they kind of blew up. They had that first album, you know, that kind of had a cult vibe to it. But it was just while they were kind of doing that transition into like a proper kind of alternative dance band. And I think it must have been sold out. It was really busy, and it was possibly one of the hottest shows I've ever been to. And then I remember the sweat running down the back of my knees, and, you know, Keith Flint's kind of flying out in a straight jacket on. And, you know, he still had the long hair, and he was just bouncing around the stage, and it just went off. And it was like, fucking hell, this is really fucking special. You know, I'm not even a big Prodigy fan. Do you know what I mean? A lot of the shows I go to, or a lot of the albums, I kind of go, that's a great record. I'm not necessarily even a big fan, but it was like, this is brilliant. And, you know, I've been to hundreds and hundreds of shows. I've seen lots of bands before they got big, you know, that some of them were good bands that got big, some of them were shit bands that got big. I've seen lots of bands that were, you know, in big venues, whatever. That show was like, this is special, you know. And who else? The Beastie Boys at the Astoria, that would have been 94 as well. I mean, there was a couple in 94 scene. I mean, I saw Oasis at the Marquee in the space of about 4 months. It was Oasis at the Marquee, the Prodigy at the Marquee, the Beastie Boys at the Astoria, which was a beautiful old venue they've knocked down now that holds maybe 1900 people. Yeah. So that was, again, that was around the time of sort of ill communication. So like Sabotage and stuff. So just they were about to get really, really big. So that was kind of special. Who else was there? Smashing Pumpkins at the Underworld, you know, again, maybe 400 people, 91 that might have been, 1990, 91, something like that. Rage Against the Machine's first UK show at the Underworld, which was you know, I think the album had been out on import. I don't think it had been released over here yet. So, you know, my mate had got it from Rough Trade on import, spent loads of money on it. And we all, you know, we'd done us all cassettes. We had our special cassette of the album and stuff. And I think literally that within a year, they'd gone from, you know, gone from watching The Underworld, might have been the same year, The Underworld to second headliner at the Reading Festival in 93. I think Porno for Pyros headlined a Friday. I think Rage were the band just before them. So that, you know, just blowing up that quickly and kind of going from that kind of literally being 5 meters away from them on stage to them being, you know, in a mosh pit with like 20,000 people or something. They was probably the first band that I saw get that big in that, you know, in that kind of period of time. But yeah, Jim, you know, I was barely in the house during the 90s, especially, I mean, up until about 2005 when I kind of got really, really ill. I was at concerts all the time, you know, the Beta Band at the Electric Ballroom in Camden. That was, you know, I think that was 98, just again around the same time the first album came out. That was a really good show. I think bands generally are at their best at the beginning of their kind of careers. So within the sort of first album or two, that's when I like to see bands. Because I think that after that, they kind of generally sort of find their sound. And then they become a bit sort of formulaic maybe, or a bit comfortable in that sound. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. They don't really maybe push themselves kind of creatively. So yeah, a lot of my favorite shows were bands kind of at the beginning of their careers, generally. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Apart from maybe like Nine Inch Nails are a band that I've kind of still love. You know, I'm still a big fan of Trent Reznor. But again, I think his first two albums are probably still his best. So... But you know what? I could bore you for hours about shows that I kind of semi-missed, but was kind of there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, great stuff. Some great acts mentioned, some great shows mentioned. Well, today's your lucky day because you get to collect your fantasy festival. So you get to choose any five acts, one of whom must play an album in full. And they all get to play a song to end your fantasy festival, which we'll call the encore. So in the last episode, I had Megan Wynn, I mentioned at the beginning. She collated her MFest Fantasy Festival. She picked up-and-coming band The Mysterines as her opening act, who were really good, actually. I listened to them this morning for the first time. Great sound they got going on. In her Super Seconds act, she picked Wolf Alice and had them performing their album Blue Weekend. In her Midway Madness slot, she picked Royal Blood. In her pre-headline act slot, she had the Rolling Stones. And headlining, as predicted, she picked Fleetwood Mac. And for her encore, she had all those five acts play The Chain. So, like that, any five acts of your choice you can pick to play your fantasy festival. But before you do, you need to give your fantasy festival a name, and we need to hold it somewhere. So what are you going to call your fantasy festival?
I think I'm going to call it Girls to the Front. Even though there are not many female acts, I was going to try and be a bit smart and just do an entire lineup of girl groups. But then I just melted, and it was like, oh, I can't leave these out. So it's not an all female lineup. But I just thought, you know, I grew up with one of the kind of scenes that I suppose I was into was the, you know, the Riot Girl kind of scene. And, you know, as much as it was about the music, you know, learning about stuff around kind of like sexism and, you know, rape and sexual assault and, you know, kind of issues around, you know, patriarchy, all that kind of stuff, which as a young boy doesn't really kind of land for me. It didn't land on my radar. None of that stuff resonated because none of it was important to me, you know. And I think that, you know, growing up through Britpop and working in Britpop as a teenager, I think that Britpop was quite a misogynistic, kind of a quite sexist music scene. You know, there was a few females involved, but I think generally with the, you know, the lad mags and you know, I don't think it was particularly kind of healthy, really. And so having it, you know, but, you know, kind of being into these Riot Girl bands and these kind of, you know, feminist punk bands, learning about that stuff, it kind of helped kind of educate me and balance my thinking out. Do you know what I mean? It made me think about things in a kind of different way. And so, like I kind of mentioned earlier with the organization sort of Safe Gigs for Women, you know, sort of had them on and, you know, doing takeovers in Neville Southall and stuff, and, you know, talking with them, it's like the rise in sexual assault in festivals and gigs, it seems to be on the rise. Do you know what I mean? It seems to be getting worse. So, you know, what I loved about, for example, Bikini Kill was they would, you know, they would make the guys kind of stand back a little bit and invite women to the front,
right,
so they could kind of mosh safely, you know, jump around safely without guys putting their hands on them, really. So my festival will have a little bit at the front where, you know, women are encouraged to kind of come and enjoy themselves safely. So that's kind of the thinking behind the name. Does that make me sound really woke and
that sounds fantastic. That sounds fantastic. And you can take us anywhere in the world. You can take us back to the Astoria. You can take us to the underworld, the ballroom. You can take us across the pond. Take us anywhere you like. So where do you want to hold Girls to the Front?
I am going to hold it at the Astoria in London for two reasons. One, the Astoria was an absolutely beautiful venue. It was just the right size for bands. You know, it was big enough that you could, you know, that it was an event, but small enough that, you know, that there was still a level of kind of intimacy to it, you know, and it just looked great as well because it was like an old theatre. And also, so it means that, you know, no one's got a camp because, like I said, I hate camping. I will travel home and drive back to the festival the next day rather than camp. I cannot do it. And I live near the Astoria, so I just got to get on the tube. So it's like 20 minutes on the tube for me. So perfect. So yeah, so we're doing it in central London. And they've got proper toilets there. So you can do nice poos.
Very important. Very important. Exactly. Great stuff. So we've got Girls to the Front at the Astoria. I guess... Before we talk about your five acts, there's probably quite a lot of acts who haven't made it. Any quick shout-outs for any acts who you wanted to put in and just haven't made the cut?
Yeah, I mean, again, I could just spend 20 minutes just machine-gunning names at you. But, I mean, there was like... Because there was some where you're kind of going, oh, you know what? The album... I want to pick... You know, that would be the album I'd want them to play. So, you know, someone like Nas doing Illmatic.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Nirvana doing In Utero... Ride doing Nowhere, Prince doing Purple Rain, you know, Lauryn Hill doing, you know, Miseducation. There were so many kind of, you know, I love those records and I love some of those artists as well. Do you know what I mean? Some of my favorite artists. But it's like the album is there's so many great albums, you know, the Beach Boys, you know, Pet Sounds or something. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. There's so many you could kind of do. So I was like, do I put those in because of that? Or then there's some of my favourite artists, which is like, you know, Johnny Cash, Dolly Parton, you know, Elton John, Husker Du. You know, I'm a massive George Michael fan, which seems to, not so much recently, but, you know, it used to make people laugh. Like it was kind of like an embarrassing, artist or something. Do you know what I mean? Like a guilty pleasure, you know, which I kind of find quite offensive, to be honest. I mean, not, I don't get offended, but I think the notion that George Michael is a guilty pleasure, for example, is ridiculous. You know, if you listen to Listen Without Prejudice, I will put that album up against anything that Lennon and McCartney wrote, which I've put on Twitter a few times, and people are surprisingly kind of aggressive in their responses to that statement, you know. But I do believe that George Michael was a spectacular songwriter and singer. Yeah. You know, I just think, unfortunately, the stuff with Sony kind of interrupted his career at his kind of creative peak, you know, and I don't ever think he, even though he was good after, I don't ever think he kind of got back to where he was with Listen Without Prejudice, for example. So yeah, so loads of, you know, the Ramones I could have had. They're, you know, they're just loads, really loads. But those are the kind of main ones who are probably some of my favourite artists.
Great stuff. George Michael never been picked for a fantasy festival. 84 episodes in, George Michael has to wait another day. Nas has to wait another day. Ramones as well have to wait another day. So some amazing acts mentioned.
No one's ever picked the Ramones.
No, they've been mentioned quite a lot. Ramones get mentioned as quite a lot in the missed acts period. Yeah, I'll send you my... I've got a spreadsheet. I'll send you my spreadsheet after. I keep a spreadsheet that I refer to.
Spreadsheet? You take this seriously.
So, you're five acts in, 2 o'clock at the Astoria. Who's going to open Girls to the Front?
Well, it's got to be Bikini Kill. It has to be Bikini Kill, you know, for a start. Yeah, I mean, they were... I'm still a massive fan. I mean, they luckily got to see them when they reformed... 2019, I'm thinking. I think it was 2019, 2018, 2019. And I tweeted, it was actually on my sobriety birthday they were playing. So I'd sort of, I tweeted, you know, going to see Bikini Kill, I think I was 12 years sober or something at the time. And then I got a tweet back from Kathleen Hanna saying, you know, your sobriety, inspires me. And it was just this, beautiful wow. tweet. And it was, I was obsessed with Kathleen Hanna as a kid. Do you know what I mean? Absolutely, obsessed. And so, you know, we kind of talk a little bit and, you know, she followed me back and, you know, now she follows me on Instagram. And, you know, I tell people that we're friends. You know, I'd be like, I'm kind of friends with Kathleen yeah. Hanna. I think if you ask Kathleen Hanna, she'd kind of go, oh, that drugs guy on social media. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm not sure she appreciates the level of our friendship. Do you know what I mean? She recognises it in the same way that I do, you know. But but yeah, no, I mean, it's like, you know, it's International Women's Day coming up soon, March the 8th, I think it is. And I always, it kind of makes me think about stuff, you know, women. And I think, you know, Kathleen Hanna kind of was probably more kind of influential in my life than most other women. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? You know, and I think I learned more about, say, stuff like, you know, patriarchy, kind of sexism, kind of, you know, issues that, you know, that affect women more from sort of her than I did from like school. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, so she's had quite a profound, and, you know, and I was, you know, I was at the biggest crush on her when I was like 13. And, you know, kind of still do. But yeah, so she's had like a really kind of profound effect on me. And I don't think she doesn't, you know, and I've kind of, when we're kind of in inboxing, I kind of sometimes feel like I should tell her, but I don't want to sound like a mental. Do you know what I mean? And she yeah. goes, oh, God, I need to block this guy, you know. But she really has in such a positive way, you know. And it's the fact now, you know, I've got children now and I've got, you know, I've got a young daughter. And even now how I am as a father, I think, you know, Kathleen's politics and music has kind of infiltrated that, you know. You know, my daughter's got a signed Bikini Kill album in her bedroom, you know, the Revolution Girl style now one. And, you know, so I'm trying to force my daughter to kind of get into Bikini Kill. So yes, I think they'd have to start any festival that's called Girls to the Front.
Great shout. So Bikini Kill, they make their Fantastival debut. They're going to play from 2 till 3 at Girls to the Front. Their debut,
No one's ever picked them before.
No, I mean, that's the beauty of the Fantastival. Everyone's got such a different view of what a fantasy, what their perfect fantasy festival is. I guess that's kind of part of the fun of it. So yeah, there you make their debut. They're going to play 2 till 3. We'll take a half hour break. 3:30 will be time for your super second act. So who are you going to have follow Bikini Kill?
Kraftwerk. Tell me someone's picked them before.
I will tell you someone's picked Kraftwerk. Kraftwerk have been picked once before in a super second slot as well.
Who picked them?
By a workmate who's a fountain of all knowledge, a guy called Mike Grant, who created an amazing fantasy festival on it. But I guess why Kraftwerk for you?
Well, just, you know, I'm a massive, massive hip hop fan. You know, specific kind of hip hop from the late 80s into sort of, you know, the golden age of hip hop, which is like, 87 to sort of 95, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, I still dip into bits and pieces now, but that period then for me, it was just so exciting kind of for hip hop. And especially kind of, you know, during the whole, you know, during the mid-90s Britpop stuff, all I did was literally listen to old hip-hop records. And, you know, I'm also into dance music and kind of electronic stuff. And I just think that, you know, none of it would exist without Kraftwerk. Like, none of it. You know, you trace it kind of back to Kraftwerk. I mean, you could also then go back further into sort of Stockhausen and the other sort of krautrock stuff. But the Kraftwerk, I mean, again, another one of my sort of controversial opinions is I think Kraftwerk were just as important as the Beatles. You know, for a lot of people, I'm not the biggest Beatles fan, so maybe that's why I say it, but,
yeah,
you know, for a lot of people, the Beatles is kind of ground zero for music. And for me, it's Kraftwerk. You know, I love them. I mean, I'm hopefully going to see them again this year. They're playing somewhere, I think they're playing Victoria Park. I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, I managed to go and see them in 2004, I think it was, at the Brixton Academy, and they did two shows on the same day. They did like a matinee show and then an evening show, which I thought there was something quite cool about it. And I couldn't get tickets for the matinee show, so we went in the evening. But by which point I'd done too much Valium and drunk too much, and the mix had kind of, I was not in the best space, and it was like, it was sold out, it was really hot in there, and it was a kind of a, it was a struggle to kind of stay stood up through it. I just remember being really kind of messy, but then they, these robots came on and they kind of played as robots. I mean, I just love everything about them. Do you know what I mean? The way that they treat music, they approach music in a, just a different way, I think, to most musicians, you know. And they're kind of, you know, and just how even now you listen to them and they still sound like the future. Yeah. How records that are like 40 years old still sound like they're the future.
Yeah.
You know?
Great shout. So Kraftwerk are your super seconds act. Second time been picked for a fantasy festival lineup. They're going to play Girls to the Front. They're going to play from 3:30 to 4:30. We'll take another half hour break. That'll take us to 5 o'clock and be time for your Midway Madness act. So who are you going to have in your Midway Madness act?
I'm going to have Parliament. Parliament stroke Funkadelic stroke any George Clinton solo stuff like Atomic Dog that he also wishes to do.
Okay, fair shout. So why them for you then? Why do they make it to Girls to the Front?
Well, again, in the same way that you know, Kraftwerk kind of, you know, the ground zero for kind of hip hop, for example. The same with Parliament. You know, I didn't get into Parliament until I was a little bit older. I was probably in my mid-teens when I really discovered Parliament and Funkadelic. You know, I was into hip-hop, and then you start digging, and someone says, oh, that's a sample from Parliament song, or you know, and you kind of go, oh, we'll never listen to that then. And so, you know, so I started discovering how much music I liked was actually inspired and sampled from Clinton, you know. And so, you know, getting more into it, then you kind of get into the Funkadelic stuff and, you know, stuff like Maggot Brain and, you know, One Nation Under a Groove. And it's like, fuck, I didn't even know, like, black people did rock music. Do you know what I mean? You know, I knew there was, like, you know, Jimi Hendrix. But, you know, I don't know about anyone else, but I don't really consider Jimi Hendrix like a black rock, you know, like the experience of black rock band. Do you know what I mean? You know, but these was like, you know, funny that they was like all black guys, and I didn't even think that they would want to do music like that. But black people don't listen to rock music, so it just blew my mind, really, as well as the fact that, you know, they were absolutely like spectacular. Do you know what I mean? And then to say that the Parliament stuff, you know, with the just, you know, the you've got bass players wearing nappies and you've got the spaceships, and it was just like, this is mental. I love it. So I'm gonna go with Parliament, George Clinton, because I think, you know, as well as being a big fan of them, the same with sort of Kraftwerk, them and Kraftwerk are probably as equally responsible for the kind of music that I you know, my favourite kind of music, which I suppose is hip hop.
Great shout! First time they've been picked for Fantasy Festival, I'm afraid to tell you.
I cannot believe this.
So Parliament, Funkadelic, George Clinton combined make up your Midway Madness slot. They're gonna play from 5 till 6. Take a half hour break, so 3 acts down, 2 acts left. So time for your pre-headline act to come on at 6:30. So who's going to take your pre-headline act slot? Who are you going to have?
Well, I was going to go with the Ramones, which now I know they've never been picked before, I probably should have done. Right, just to be the first. But in the end, I kind of settled for Sonic Youth.
Good shout. I mean, Sonic Youth, first time they've been picked on the Fantastical podcast. Got a few firsts on this episode today.
I'm amazed by this.
So why Sonic Youth for you? Obviously, like a massively influential band, but why Sonic Youth for you?
Do you know what I love? I mean, for a start, they got Kim Gordon in the band who I love, right? And kind of started off my, I think she probably started off my obsession with kind of female bass players. But they just, for me, are just kind of like one of the, visually one of the most perfect bands. Like, I look at them, like them and the, you know, the Ramones were another band. You look at them and go, they look so fucking cool. I want to be in that band. I want to look like that. Do you know what I mean? And I loved, you know, I'm a big, I suppose, you know, stuff like the Pixies, you know, Husker Du, Bob Mould, you know, obviously Nirvana. They, you know, they kind of spawned all of that stuff, I suppose. I mean, obviously, you go back to, say, the Ramones, the, you know, and into the punk stuff and, you know, MC5. And so you can always, you know, you can trace it all back further. But the, you know, the connection, I suppose, between sort of Sonic Youth and what that sort of late 90s alternative punk, you know, alternative American rock stuff is just, you know, you, it's you can follow it, you can trace it very clearly. And as much as they were kind of, I say, just a punk band, or, you know, a punk rock band, it sounds very dismissive. They kind of approached it in what I would consider kind of a highbrow way. You know, it has the feel of like improvised jazz about it. You know, I find their kind of early music. It was just slightly more intelligent and experimental than most other kind of punk bands, I suppose, you know? And I love them. I love Sonic Youth. I love Kim Gordon. And they were one of the few bands where I kind of, as a kid, would like, fuck, I wish I was in Sonic Youth. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, I never really wanted to be in bands and stuff. It was never really, I learned very quickly that I was never going to be in a band and have that kind of talent. But, you know, they were one band you kind of go, do you know what? I want to be the singer in Sonic Youth, and I want to be married to Kim Gordon. Do you know what I mean? It was sort of 14 years old. That was the dream.
It's a great shout there. Sonic Youth, your pre-headline act slot. They're going to play for an hour and a half at Astoria from 6:30 to 8:00. So half hour break, and then your headline act are going to come and play for 2.5 hours from 8:30 to 11:00. So who's going to headline Girls to the Front?
Well, I took this question very seriously. Because initially I was like, okay, well, it's called Girls to the Front, so Bikini Kill will have to headline. And then I'm kind of like, I'm dropping in. Who could headline? Who can play for 2.5 hours? Who could hold people's attention? Who do I like? Because obviously, there's plenty of headline acts, but maybe I'm not the biggest fan, or I've got no interest in seeing them. I thought, the only band, really, the best festival headliner of the last 25 years, the Chemical Brothers. I literally don't think, a lot of people love the Chemical Brothers, and they're kind of, within dance circles, they're kind of revered. But I don't think they get the credit they probably deserve. You know, if you're talking about them as like musicians, as musicians or artists or as a band, whatever kind of word you want to sort of attach to them. I don't think there's been anyone in the last 25 years that's had a career like theirs. I don't think they've made a bad album. I'm not even sure how many albums they made. They must have done over 10 albums now, 10, 12 albums, right? They've not made a bad record, And I was kind of thinking about it a little while ago, and it was kind of like, bands have runs where they might be for 3 years or 5 years. I think Radiohead throughout the 90s into the 2000s were pretty solid, Or, Bowie in the 70s, lost his way a bit in the 80s, but in the 70s, it was a decade of just being magnificent, Prince throughout the whole 80s. Again, I think Prince kind of lost his way in the 90s. 70s Elton John, again, the 80s stuff, very hit and miss. I think the Chemical Brothers, since like literally the first album, 1994, I don't think they've made a bad record. I genuinely don't think they've ever sort of dipped. They've had albums that have been better than other albums, obviously. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I just think that they have just, and live, they are just, it's just a spectacular like experience. Do you know what I mean? My friend Adam does all the visuals, and they're just amazing, because it's very hard when you've got two guys just pressing buttons. That can be kind of boring, just watching two guys standing there behind keyboards and computers. There's nothing really kind of engaging about that, generally speaking. Do you know what I mean? Which is why the Prodigy had kind of Keith and the other guy, I can't remember his name now, that was the MC. It added something to live performance. The Chemical Brothers don't have that. So, what engages the audience is all the visual stuff, which again has been, Adam's done it since the very beginning, I think since they was, since their first single. And so he's like, I think he's referred to as the third Chemical Brother. But with it, his visuals are great, and the music is spectacular as well. And I genuinely don't think there's been an act I don't know, maybe you can think of someone that for 22 years has been really good and not done. And you look at stuff like, Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan's done a lot of shit records, done some absolutely amazing stuff. But there's a lot of stuff where unless you're a Bob Dylan purist, you ain't really feeling it. Do you know what I mean?
Smash out, yeah.
The Rolling Stones, they had that period in the sort of, up until 72 or 74. That's kind of it, really. Do you know what I mean? U2, I'm not a big, I hate U2. But, there's a period where people, U2, they kind of go, that mid-80s to Octopus Baby, maybe.
Yeah.
Great albums. Rarely is a band that had even longer than 10 years. So to have it for 22 years as it stands, I just think is incredibly impressive. And as I say, I've never seen a festival go off like it has when they're playing. People lose their fucking minds. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's carnage. It looks great. You know, especially when you're stood at the back, well out of the way from it, all sober. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's they're my headline act.
Fantastic stuff. Second time they've been picked for a fantasy festival. So the Chemical Brothers are headlining Girls to the Front. And at 11 o'clock, they're going to finish their set and they're going to welcome back on stage Sonic Youth, Parliament, Kraftwerk and Bikini Kill. And they'll get to play one song to close down Girls to the Front. So what are you going to have as your encore to finish the evening?
Do you know what? I thought about it and it's like, what song? Because again, I've taken it very seriously. So it would have to be a song that would work. And then I was like, I couldn't find a song that would work with all of these acts without it just being ridiculous. So I thought I'm going to pick my favourite single, which is Tiny Dancer by Elton John, which is like, I could just listen to that over and over again. Like I said, I'm a massive fan of 70s Elton, and specifically that, I think that song is just, it's just a beautiful record. It reminds me of my daughter. I force her to listen to it with me. So yeah, they will come on and they will sing Tiny Dancer by Elton John.
Love it. Great shout. What act are you going to play your full album?
I was going to go with Sonic Youth, Daydream Nation. And then I was like, well, you know what? It has to be Parliament with Motor Booty Affair, which is, I think it came out in 1974. And it is the album that my daughter was born to. So the first noise that she heard was the P-Funk. So she was born to the sounds of the P-Funk. And it has to be that album. And I was lucky enough, again, sort of like I mentioned earlier about sort of working in the music industry, being around the music industry, I'm able to kind of get stuff that, you know, some people can't get, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like signed Taylor Swift pictures. And about five, six years ago, maybe, I got to meet George Clinton.
Wow.
And I knew I was going to meet him. So I've turned up with a limited edition picture disc of Motor Booty Affair, which is, it's a picture of George surfing on top of a dolphin whilst dressed as a cowboy in a cowboy hat and chaps, holding a ghetto blaster, right? And I got him to sign the record to my daughter, and he drew the little dog face that he does on it as well. So she's got that kind of framed in her room. So that album, even though it's a great record, it's not one of my favourite albums, it's not one that I listen to particularly often, just for, you know, because it was the album that I sort of chose my daughter to be born to, it kind of obviously holds special kind of memories. So that's the album that's getting played in full.
That's amazing. That's brilliant. So let's lock this bad boy in then. So we've got Girls to the Front taking place at Astoria. Opening that, we've got Bikini Kill. Super Seconds, we've got Kraftwerk. Midway Madness, we've got Parliament, Funkadelic, George Clinton playing, Motor Booty Affair. Pre-headline act, we've got Sonic Youth. Headlining your fantasy festival, we got the Chemical Brothers. And for your encore, they're all going to play Tiny Dancer. That's a pretty impressive lineup. You happy with that? Happy to lock that one in?
I am happy to lock that one in. I mean it.
That is done. I'd love to go back to the Astoria. Obviously, we can't, but great venue, great memories there. I saw so many great gigs back in the day at the Astoria.
Did you see that?
I saw Ryan Adams in my first Ryan Adams show support himself. So came out and done an acoustic show to support himself and then came out with his full band. I saw, Embrace, Cast, Hope of the States, The Streets, which was the strongest smelling weed smell at a gig.
I think I was at The Streets show there.
Yeah, it was like an NME show. It must have been like 2000 or 2001 maybe.
I think it'd been 2001.
Yeah, just like loads of those NME shows there. I think I saw the music there as part of on that as well. Just loads of like great acts you look back on and go, yeah, man, great times.
Yeah, and the LA 2 underneath it.
Yes.
Some great
venues there. So before we finish this one off, then, let's push the social post. So you can be found at Twitter at Secret Drug Addict. Then you're also on Instagram as well, right?
I am, yes. Although I'm not so great on Instagram, it kind of bores me. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do on Instagram. It just seems to be people posting pictures themselves, which is a bit difficult if you're trying to stay anonymous. But I am on there, but I'm much funnier. Oh, I mean, literally on Instagram, it's just me just like stealing people's memes and stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm much funnier on Twitter, much more entertaining on Twitter. So give me a follow on either if you can be asked.
Yeah, definitely give that account a follow. You will not be sorry. So that is it. Thanks to everyone for listening to the 84th episode of the Fantastival podcast. And if you've enjoyed this one, please subscribe. Give the podcast a review if you're listening on iTunes, or if you're listening on Spotify, you can now go to rate the show and give us a review as well. We are on Twitter as well, so if you don't follow us, make sure you do at FantastivalP. And if you want to email the podcast, you can do it fantastivalpodcast@outlook.com. Unfortunately, you can't play music on podcasts, but I'll get some tracks off the SDA and I will make a Spotify playlist and put all the tracks into there. So a massive thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been great listening to you talk all about your Twitter account, like your career in the music industry. And I've got to say, like, a massive well done for all the great work you do with yourself and your new account and Neville. And it's been great to get to know you and catch up with you.
No, thanks for having us. I say, normally I'd just get asked to go on podcasts and talk about addiction. So it's nice to come on to a podcast and talk about something else, especially music.
Yeah, great. And you certainly know your stuff and have been there, seen it, done it. So I'll be back next week with episode number 85. So please make sure to join me. But until then, stay safe, my Fantastival friends. Please continue to spread the word. And that word is Fantastival. Thanks for listening.